everyone, and welcome to the Keep or Cut podcast, a podcast here on the Pitcherless Podcast Network. That's a lot of alliteration there, Chad. I don't know how you do this every week. It is Pete hosting this week. Chad, what's going on, dude?
Pete on the Pitcherless Podcast Network.
Yeah, that's a mouthful. How you doing, Chad? Your Cavaliers are looking pretty good. This isn't a basketball podcast, but I got to say, the Cavs are firing on all cylinders here.
Yeah, they look great, and I'm bummed about the loss in Boston, but that game also, like, the Celtics shot like 60% from three or something ridiculous, right? Like that, and it's like, okay, like, what are you gonna do?
I mean, when like, you get your undefeated streak live with broken that. By the reigning champions, like, that's just, you know, you just, yeah. And then I believe the Cavs turned it around and literally won the next night. So, I mean,
They had a back to back. They went home the next night and took care of business. So I'm a little annoyed because the in-season tournament, which I was sort of questioning how I'd feel about that, but I really enjoyed it the last couple of years. But that loss to Boston was part of the in-season tournament. Mm-hmm. So we've now lost one game in the whole year, but it matters for that. And then the Hawks went out and lost to the Bulls, which messed us up because the Hawks had beat the Celtics. And if the Cavs had beat the Hawks and those three teams all had one loss, the Hawks beat the Celtics pretty badly. Mm-hmm. And the Celts-Cavs score was close. And so point differential, that was it. All we had to do was comfortably beat the Hawks, and we were going to win the group. And now we need the Celtics to lose to someone, or we need to somehow get through as the wild card. I'm bummed about that. But
yeah, well,
I'll get over it if we go like 71-11 or something, which, you know, we're not going to do. But we're on pace for it.
Hell yeah, you are. Hell yeah, you are.
Run pace, you know, 64-4 at this rate. And then we got another.
Yeah, I'm riding Donovan Mitchell train in fantasy, man. That's for sure. I still haven't taken up Otonou fantasy basketball, but maybe next season. Anyway.
It's fun. I play Otonou fantasy basketball, and it's the only fantasy basketball I do. And it's like, I really like it. It's getting me more into the NBA. So
that's good. Check it out. Hey, growing the sport. That's what fantasy is all about. Well, that and winning. But folks, we have an interesting show for you today. Chad and I are going to talk through some questions about fantasy leagues. Definitely those of you that are in the listener leagues, you know, we're going to talk about stuff that relates to that, but also just fantasy leagues in general, you know, setting up kind of your settings, your expectations for drafts and kind of the order of doing certain things, which is putting it very vaguely. But this episode is going to be a little bit all over the place in a good way, like a typical off-season episode. But before we get into that kind of stuff, it is episode 155. Hard to believe we're 155 in. And so we're going to talk about jersey number 55 in baseball history. And this one's interesting. I guess the two most tenured guys with the number 55 and the highest WAR would be Oral Hershiser for the Dodgers, then Indians, now Guardians, and the Mets. And then Russell Martin, who bumped all over the place but kept that number 55 the whole time. And then I love looking at, like, the random one-offs, Chad, of, like, guys who wore it for one season. Like, I didn't even know Derek Lowe spent a season with the Texas Rangers. Super random.
Yeah, and Derek Lowe's on there, but there's a whole Dodgers contingent here, because obviously you mentioned Hershiser and Martin being the guys who sort of actually owned this number. But Pujols wore it in his not even a full season with the Dodgers. Ron Fairley had a season with the Dodgers. He wore it. There was one other name I saw on here. I thought maybe I'm wrong, but yeah, there's like a whole bunch of, I don't know. There are a bunch of one-offs. 55 is a very popular one-off number. But the guy who stood out to me, although he's not in the Hershiser or Martin tier in terms of career, but peak. Yeah. Peak. I think so. Tim Lincecum. And for me, as both as a fantasy player, but also just as a guy who remembers watching Lincecum pitch in his prime, he was insanely, insanely good for a period of time there. And the longevity wasn't there. The arm health wasn't there. And so it was only, you know, a decade, but man, it was like, there were some high heights in Tim Lincecum's time wearing number 55.
Heck yeah. I'd definitely give it to Timmy. I didn't see him down there. I'm kind of surprised, you know, because you see 10 years, you'd expect maybe the WAR to be a little bit higher, but you're right, the peak was short, a lot of injuries in there. But yeah, if we're talking fantasy relevance during my playing time anyway, Tim Lincecum was the SP one quite a few seasons. So I'm all on board on the Tim Lincecum episode. Yeah,
the crazy thing with Lincecum is, so you know, we look at this list. There's a list that you can find on Baseball Reference where you can sort by, you know, look at jersey numbers, sort by the number of years somebody wore it, sort by their career WAR. And Lincecum shows up a little bit down the list because he only had 19.9 career WAR according to Baseball Reference. After his, let's think about this, through his first five seasons, which is his rookie season where he made 24 starts, and then his four consecutive All-Star seasons. At the end of that, he had well over 20 WAR. Right, he put up 2.3, 7.8, 7.4, 3.3, and 3.7. So that was like, let's see, 23.5 WAR through five seasons, which is just an insane rate of production. And then it all fell apart, right? He had injuries. He just wasn't the same after that. And in the next five seasons, he obviously had he had negative WAR in four of those five seasons. So that is how he ended up below 20 for his career. I mean, he was at 27 years old. If you had told me he was destined for the Hall of Fame, I would have been like, yeah, of course he is. And he's not going to sniff it. But man, especially those two, you know, back-to-back Cy Young awards. Is that right? Back-to-back Cy Youngs in 2008 and 2009. Mm-hmm. He was just on another planet. It was, yeah.
So such a small frame too, yeah. But yeah. All right. The Tim Lincecum episode. So let's dive into some of the stuff that we're going to discuss today. You know, getting leagues ready, talking about, you know, league settings really, and keeper settings, and you know, minor league draft settings. And that's kind of the one we're going to start off with here. So, you know, Chad, you referenced to me in our Discord chat that you were discussing what the pros and cons are of having your minor league draft or auction take place before or after your actual league's auction or draft. And I got thinking, like, I'm trying to think back if I had ever participated in a prospect draft before a draft or auction, and I can definitely say I never have.
Yeah.
And when I think about it, like, baseball teams don't think about it this way, right? Like, they don't think, all right, you know what, our outfield isn't super deep, so let's spend our first round pick on an outfielder, because players are so far away. Like, the Red Sox just drafted Braden Montgomery, and it's like, oh, we have all these outfielders. No, we don't. We don't know what Braden Montgomery is. He might not be in the big leagues for 4 years. So it doesn't really matter. But in fantasy, it kind of does, right? So when I was thinking about it, I'm like, it kind of makes sense that we've always done it after, because you may think like, all right, my outfield is a little thin. I think I want to spend my first, you know, overall pick in the prospect draft on Roman Anthony or something like that. So I was curious, you know, where this comes from and where do you land on this debate?
Yeah. So I play in three leagues that have a specific minor league portion. I've explained a lot more leagues than that have minor leaguers involved, but like, you know, most auto new leagues, prospects are just part of your roster, right? There's no separate prospect draft. I do play in one auto new league, and that's where this conversation came up from, that does what we call a 5 MILB, which is a 5-round draft that is outside of your 40 players, 400-man roster that allows you to draft minor league players. And leagues that do this, they have different rules. The league I'm in, to be eligible for this draft, the player has to have not debuted. They have to be in a major league organization. So like, for example, a guy like Sasaki will not be eligible for any of this until he's actually signed, but they have to be in a major league org. They have to have not debuted yet. And they can't have been on an active auto-new roster when salaries increased at the end of the year, which I know feels like a sort of an arbitrary thing, but we wanted the rule we really wanted to have in place was, if this is a guy who's been on like a regular 40-man roster, they shouldn't be on a minor league roster in a future year. But the context we set for that was to avoid somebody doing something like signing 50 random prospects in September and immediately cutting them. But if you actually hold them, if you get your roster legal and you hold a guy through the end of the season, that guy shouldn't be eligible for this minor league draft. So that draft has traditionally happened after the auction. And we were discussing, and Sasaki comes up because he was sort of relevant here, was like, well, is he eligible for this draft? Someone new in the league was asking that. And I was like, doesn't matter. I mean, I guess technically he is. He'll be a prospect who hasn't debuted, but like someone will pick him up at the auction, of course. And the guy was like, wait, the auction, you know, what's the order here? And I realized like our listener league, we have a minor league portion. One of our listener leagues has a minor league portion of the draft. That happens at the end. It's the last three rounds of the draft. My CBS head-to-head league that I've talked about before has a rookie draft, they call it, our minor league draft, that is before the auction. And so the top pick in that draft this year will probably be Sasaki. It was Yamamoto last year. That's pretty typical. And there was a movement to shift the order for this Auto New League to put the five minor league player draft before the auction. I was against it. And at first I was like, this seems crazy to me. Why would you do that? And then I realized, oh, my other league does this and it sort of makes sense. And so I think it comes down to a question of what you're trying to do. So for me in Auto New, the goal of that five minor league draft is to expand the player universe, right? To bring in five prospects, or really 60 prospects, right? Five per team who otherwise wouldn't be rostered. And that's what I enjoy about it. That's what makes it sort of fun for me. And so having it before the draft doesn't work then, right? Because people are going to draft Sasaki and I'm trying to think of guys who aren't already rostered, who are like potential breakout prospects. It's one of the things that's weird about this draft is like, because so many guys are already rostered, it can be a challenge to find guys who are eligible. You're moving pretty far down the prospect list usually, which is, again, that's what I like about it, right? It's all guys who you wouldn't want on a regular roster. But like I have Sebastian Walcott. I drafted him last year, right? He wasn't a guy who last year really was on the radar at the beginning of the season for Auto New purposes, but belonged there for that purpose. Leodalis DeVries is on someone's roster there. But I'm scrolling through MLB.com's top 100 and like here, Thomas White is number 46 on that list. Left-handed pitcher for the Marlins. I don't think he's rostered in that league. He'll be eligible for that draft. But if somebody wants to spend a dollar on him or $2 on him at the auction, I think they should be able to, right? Just like you would in a normal league. And then the idea is that if that guy is gone and now all of a sudden you have to look at the bottom part of the top 100 into the guys who are like outside the top 100 and the top 200, you're actually expanding the universe. Whereas if you do the draft, the prospect draft first, you draft Sasaki in the prospect draft, you draft that white guy I just mentioned in the prospect draft. And then in the auction, you can't pick up those guys, but you don't go buy prospect number 175 because they're not worth having on your roster for a buck. You go buy another like platoon outfielder or something. And that's just not what I'm looking to do. In my CBS league, it's about parity. Before I was in the league, there was apparently an issue where there were one or two managers who were just more familiar with the minor leagues than anyone else. And every year they would go out in mid-season and pick up four guys who would all then suddenly be top 10 prospects at some point in the future, which seemed like, you know, if you don't follow the minor leagues, that's like crazy. How do they find these guys? If you're listening to this podcast, there's a good chance you follow the minor leagues closely enough that like June, July roll around and you're like, yeah, I have a good sense of like Sebastian Walcott is popping up. Roman Anthony is popping up. Christian Campbell is popping up. Like you know, those guys are coming. So the idea there was, we're going to stop people from picking up minor leaguers. We're going to go to this draft. We're going to do it first. And we're going to use it as a way to distribute anyone who hasn't debuted in a different way. And so the fact that like Yamamoto, Sasaki, those guys go there is fine. That's part of it's part of the purpose of the draft, is to get those guys to teams that need the help. So yeah, I think that's sort of what it comes down to, is like, if you're going to do a minor league draft, figure out why you're doing it. What's the purpose of doing it? And the other thing to figure out is like, how much overlap is there between your regular roster and your minor league roster? Like you mentioned major league teams don't worry about these kinds of things. Part of that is like, they're totally unrelated groups of players. Like no one's like, oh man, we have to do rule five before the college draft because someone might take this, like they're unrelated sets of players. There's no overlap. So there's no risk of that happening. You can do them any order you want. In our drafts, like in our keeper league, our keeper listener league, where we have the minor league last three rounds, you can take prospects any round you want, right? You could take you could take Sebastian Walcott in the third round if you wanted to. I wouldn't recommend it. It doesn't seem like a good idea, but you could. It's just that when we get to the minor league rounds, you can only take minor leaguers, and only the guys you take in those rounds can sit in a minor league spot. So for us, the purpose of that draft was we wanted a minor league system. We wanted guys who you could stash without impacting your roster. And so it goes after the draft. Yeah. So if you're going to do a minor league draft, you just got to figure out like, why are we doing this? What do we want it to be? And that'll help you determine if you should go before or after your regular draft. I think in general, I prefer after because I would rather, in my mind, if there's a player eligible for both, and a manager wants to pay for that player via auction or a real draft pick in the regular draft, they should be able to. But I also get why the CBS league I'm in doesn't do it that way.
Yeah, that last bit there was what I was going to add is, you know, in a keeper league like the ones that we have in the UnFanTrax, the Keeper Cut Listener League 1 and 2, and obviously 2 is the one with the minor league system, like, I feel like it kind of takes a little bit of strategy out of it and a little bit of originality out of it if you have that prospect draft beforehand, right? Because then you know who's available, you know what's there. But, you know, if this draft rolls around and I'm like, I don't care that I'm going to spend an 11th round pick on Roman Anthony, I'm confident he's going to start the season, I think he's going to be awesome, then like I should have that right to take him. And you know what? It's on me if it falls apart, because not only did I use that pick, but now instead of getting him in the prospect draft where he wouldn't even have a keeper cost until I promoted him, his keeper cost is now, you know, a 9th round pick or whatever it moves up to due to inflation in that league. So I think doing it before, at least for your standard snake drafts, is really just, you know, cutting people's legs out and taking some originality out of it. But in the auction format, in kind of the way you put it for those leagues, it does make sense. But I definitely prefer the way we do it in Keeper Cut League number 2. Before we move to our next topic, talking about league adjustments and things like that during this typical off-season episode, we are going to take our first break. We'll be right back. All right, folks, welcome back. Keeper Cut Podcast, Pete Ball, Chad Young, episode 155. We're talking about different rule changes and aspects of leagues, and we're now going to get into Keeper Cut Listener League number 2. But again, even if you're not in that league, which most of our listeners are not, right? There's 10 of them in there, plus me and Chad. These are things that could apply to any of your leagues and just kind of general fantasy baseball conversation about settings and all these kind of details that could go into your keeper leagues. And so we're having a vote. Chad put together some potential rule changes. I'm trying to remain neutral on them as I am a host of the show, but some of these questions we can probably get through kind of quickly. And the first vote that we're having is, should we add an IR spot for this year? Now, I'm interested to hear, Chad, some of the context. My school year has been a little chaotic, so I haven't been able to keep up with the Discord as much as I'd maybe like to, but I know we have 4 IR spots already.
Three.
In that league.
Three. We had,
oh, okay. 3. I have Mountcastle, Riley, and Glasnow on the IR, and it says I have 1 spot available.
That's because I added the 4th because the vote passed.
Oh, okay. So the vote passed. So we were at 3 and now we have, yes, how many?
4.
We have just 4. By 1. So like, what kind of goes into that decision making? Is it just like, you know, someone who had a bunch of injuries and is like, it would have been nice to have 1 more, so we just keep boosting it? Or is there a real thought process behind 4, like 2 pitchers, 2 hitters in an ideal world?
Yeah.
What went into that call?
So this actually started back during the season, early in the season. You know, there was a period of time, and it continued through a lot of the year, but there's a period of time early this year where like pitchers were just, you know, falling off the face of the earth every 3 seconds. And you and
that's
I
changed.
What?
That's changed.
Yeah, well, it got real bad for a while there. You and I co-manage a team in a dynasty league that Matt Heckman runs, and someone made an ask in that league to add, like, I think we also had three IR spots. Someone was like, we had a fourth or a fifth. Like, this seems crazy. And in a dynasty league, like, people were like, I'm going to be forced to drop players that I would be keeping for a decade because I just don't have enough roster space because of all these injuries. And Matt made the call and said, hey, okay, if everyone's up for it, we voted. Everyone's like, yeah, let's do it. I think we had one or two spots. Later that week, Matt, who was in Listener League 2, said, hey, can we do the same thing here? And I said, I'm up to take a vote on it. And then somebody pointed out correctly that we have a thing in our constitution for the league about doing rule changes in the offseason. And the offseason is the appropriate time to do that. And I was like, you're right. That is the appropriate time to do this. And Matt kind of gave me a hard time. He was like, you were just part of the group that was saying it was fine to do it in my other league. Like, well, now you're going to cut me off here. And I was like, eh, rules are rules. That's what they're there for. But it was sort of a, you know, it came up back then. And so I do put in anytime I'm running a league like this, I always try to make the first thing we do in the offseason be, hey, are we changing any rules for next year? And then the other piece of that is make sure that rule changes go into effect at a time far enough out into the future that you're not messing people up or causing people to vote for or against a rule based on their current situation. So, like, adding an IR spot you can do right now, right? Because we're not using the IR in the offseason anyways. It's fine. We also will talk about some of these other rules are around, like, how do keepers work. Like, we're not changing a keeper rule right now. Any vote we take now to change a keeper rule goes into effect next offseason, because what you don't want to do is take someone who, like, made a trade in July expecting to be able to keep a guy and suddenly be told now, sorry, that doesn't work anymore. So that's part of it. But this one was just a simple, like, hey, guys are getting injured at a high rate. We don't want to have to cut as many players as we had to this year. Should we, should we make some cuts, or should we extend our IR system so we don't have to make some cuts is really what I meant to say. And so we took a vote. And in this case, what I basically did was just put up a vote of no, we shouldn't. We should add one spot or we should add two spots. I felt like we were at three. Getting up to six felt crazy. And so four or five seemed like 3, 4, or 5. Those are the right numbers. The vote so far, 9 teams voted, and we got a no, 6 ones, and 2 twos. And the guy who voted for the no said, like, all right, if I have to choose, I would choose one, which was going to be my next step. My next step was going to be like a runoff to determine which one. I said, all right, fine. If you're going to do that, let's just do it. We'll add the one. We'll call it a day. I don't think there's a ton of rationale into why it's 4 instead of 5. I voted for 4 instead of 5. It felt like, I don't know. I thought 3 was kind of fine. I think there is some value in forcing those tough roster decisions. Like, it isn't supposed to be easy all the time. And so I agree that we needed more, but I didn't want to go crazy. And I also think, like, if we spend all this season being like, gosh, 4 was just still not enough, well, we'll vote again.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think I'm a little bit radical in my approach to IR slots, and I'll talk about that in a second. But I think it's, folks, if you haven't changed your IR or IL, sorry, I'm in basketball and football mode at the moment. But if you haven't changed your IL spots in a long time, you might want to take a look, because ever since we had this shift to the 10-day IL, I think it actually started with concussions and then it just carried over to it's just the 10-day IL, at least for pitchers in most cases. Ever since that took place, we see teams more likely to just throw a guy on the IL because they want the roster spot and they can survive without him for 10 days, but without for 15 days and taking him out of his routine for that long can be a little bit more difficult. And so we're seeing more and more guys go on the IL. In terms of IL, I'm going to keep doing that. In terms of IL spots in your leagues, honestly, I see the merit in what you just said, like forcing managers to make difficult decisions. It just comes down to, preference, right? And for me, I find the game more fun when it's like, instead of punishing, and it's not punishing, I get that, but like the guy who ends up with DeGrom on the IL and Sale on the IL and Yordan Alvarez on the IL all within a week. And it's like, he's totally screwed. He's going to have to cut one or just make it work. I think it'd be more fun if there were just unlimited IL slots. Throw them all in the IL and let that manager be creative and figure it out, because what that does is it gives more players value in your player universe, and it just makes your league that much deeper. And I think in some ways it can make it more competitive, because guys who are pretty good at finding those replacements will be able to continue to succeed. Whereas it's in certain leagues, I mean, depending on your keeper setting, you could find yourself in some impossible situations when it comes to cuts, where it's like, you know what? I just have to roll out Luis Robert in my outfield, even though he's on the IL, because I can't cut him and I can't cut these other guys because maybe I got him for like a 16th round pick and that's just too good. Like I found myself, I mean, this affected me in keeper cut league too. I cut Ronald Acuna Jr., man.
Yeah.
That sucked. And like, I wasn't going to keep him. I couldn't keep him, but now someone else can for a, you know, 6,000th round pick. I think it actually is Matt Hackman, which is like, that's part of the strategy, right? I was up against it. I had to cut him. It's just unfortunate. I think it'd be more fun to have unlimited IL slots, and like the punishment is not like, haha, you have to cut Ronald Acuna. You already lost him. Like, that's the punishment. You're going to replace Ronald Acuna with Austin Slater now. So like, now you also have to cut Ronald Acuna and then replace him with Austin Slater. That's just a lot. So I think unlimited IL slots is great, but I'm fine with whatever. I think four is probably going to be plenty.
Yeah, I think I like those trade-offs. I do think, like, in keeper leagues, you end up with these weird situations where it's like, you had Acuna as a first-round pick. You couldn't keep him. So there's no benefit to you holding him on your roster all year for you, except to prevent somebody else from keeping him for a 28th round pick. And I get why you did what you did. I think I dropped someone in a similar situation. It is what it is. We're talking about some other rules. Some of the other rule changes we're going to talk about now came up because of that, not necessarily because of Acuna specifically, but because of this, like, so many of our keepers are fab pickups, that there were some questions about, like, are we structuring this the right way? So, yeah.
Yeah, so that was the next one. So vote two was, should we limit the number of fab pickups who are kept? And I'm very glad that we did not do that. In a league that was, let's say it's not fab, right? And it's just daily pickups and you can add and drop and do it 1,000 times a day. It doesn't matter. I would understand limiting that because it's, you know, people who are just quick and more on it get it, but everybody has a chance to bid on all of these available players, and that's the price that you pay. And so if you're just really good at reading the data and maybe you get a little bit lucky and you end up with a bunch of guys who are, you know, on the back end of the keeper cost spectrum there, where they're basically free because they cost, you know, a last round pick or whatever it might be. If you keep multiple of them, obviously each one gets a tiny bit more expensive, then like, good for you. And I think the most important reason we have to keep this rule is for teams that are out of it. Like, if they can't even add players and keep them for, like, what is the incentive, right? At the end of the day, it's free fantasy baseball and we all love it, right? You're in a keeper cut, you know, listener league for free. Like, you just love fantasy baseball. But if you limit that, like, at some point people are just, what is left there for me to do with my team? It's way out of contention. Sure, these prospects would be exciting to add and I could keep them for free, but I can't, or not prospects, but you get what I'm saying, these young guys who I have my eye on. So like, it just kind of takes a lot of the fun out of it. Too much nanny state for me if we made that switch.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And I think for me, this is also a case of like, I like keeping as many strategies as possible open. And there's like, if you've picked up 9 free agents and you want to keep them all, like that's great. There's risk to that. It's low cost risk, 100%. But you're like, that means you're sort of by definition, like you're not keeping any true stars, unless you happen to be, you know, the person who picked up Acuna after he got cut. But in general, and like, if I go look at my, like if I pull up my list of potential keepers from League One, not the league where we voted on this, but League One, I'll look at it anyway. It's the same concept. My guys who I picked up via Fab who are keeper options are Yiner Diaz, Byron Buxton, Spencer Schwellenbach, Elliot Ramos, Reynaldo Lopez, Ranger Suarez, Reed Detmers, Masataka Yoshida, Bowden Francis, Albert Suarez, Luis Ortiz, Rhett Lauder. That's basically it. Now, woof. Some of those guys are not interesting at all. But like, if I want my strategy to be like, look, I'm keeping my rotation is going to be Schwellenbach, Bibee, Francis, Reynaldo Lopez, and Ranger Suarez. Like, there's risk associated with that. There's a reason none of those guys. Bibee wasn't one of those guys. I could keep Bibee for a 28th round pick, but that's or a 26th round pick. That's a different. That's because I kept him the year before. But like, I could keep all those guys, and maybe I will. But there's risk associated with that as compared to keeping a guy like, I don't know, this team, I don't have very good options for keepers, actually. So, but, I don't know. I like, had he stayed healthy, an eighth round Shane Bieber, right? Now, he's not going to be back, I think, early enough in the season to justify an eighth round cost. He's not going in an eighth round ADP right now. So, like, that's not going to be what I do. But, like, I you're making a real trade-off when you take those risks. And it's a valid trade-off, and I like having those options open. So I'm with you. I'm glad that this rule did not pass. We didn't even get into like what the limit would look like. It was just a should we have a limit for now? And the decision was, no, we should not have a limit. And I think that was the right call.
Yeah, yeah, I agree with that. And I agree with the example there too, right? There and what you said, there's so much risk involved with keeping nine guys, if we want to call it that, that were not on rosters to start the season the year before. Like that is, or at some point were dropped. There is risk involved there. So vote three was related to this, Chad. It says, if we don't limit the number of fab keepers, should we increase the cost of fab keepers? I've just read that like three times to myself and like, if we don't limit the number of fab keepers, should we increase the cost? Does that mean like how much it escalates by?
Yeah. So the idea was that right now you can keep a fab keeper is a 20th round pick, which is our last round. And the question was basically, should they be like a 26th or a 25th round pick? Like, should we at least like drop, like, is that just too low a cost when so many guys are kept that way? I voted no. I don't think we should. I think the reality is if you keep four or five of these guys, you're up to a 24th, 25th round pick anyways. So like,
right.
It comes together that way anyways. But interestingly, we had, again, we've had nine votes on this and seven of the nine were to increase the cost by something. But there was a split between whether it should be a two round increase or a three round increase. And so we have to have a follow-up vote to determine whether or not like what that number is going to be. It looks like but this also then got tied in with vote number four, and we'll discuss this in a minute, but there's a chance that even though the vote for this was a yes, we're going to then reject that. Basically what this comes down to is there were so many fab players being kept and likely to be kept that people wanted to address that somehow. And so one way to address it was to limit the number. One way to address that was to increase the cost. The third way to address that was if players are dropped, like that Acuna you were talking about, should their keeper cost stay the same? Right. And that was our vote four. And I'll just introduce that now. But like that one also passed and it passed pretty clearly. It was a 7-1 vote so far. And so what that means is like if I go through and I look at all those fab players, a lot of those fab players are guys who were drafted and then later cut and I picked them up. And now those guys, instead of being a fab keeper, instead of being a 28th round keeper, would be whatever they were drafted for. And so basically what it means is the draft sets the keeper cost for every player in the league. If they're not drafted, then they're a 28th round keeper. If they are drafted, they're two rounds higher than wherever they were drafted. And that would limit the number of fab keepers and it would resolve this issue with a guy like Acuna. You could cut him without risk because his keeper cost wouldn't change. Somebody else could pick him up. Like if you had a reasonably priced Acuna, somebody else could pick him up and get that reasonably priced Acuna, but they don't get a obscenely cheap Acuna, which someone did get this time. So we basically have these three different options to address this issue. And then because two of them passed, we passed both the increasing cost and the keep a player's cost. I basically said, let's take a vote on whether we want to do just one of those, just the other, or both, because I don't know that we need both. And Pete, if you haven't voted yet, you have a chance to close out the voting on this if you would like, because right now we have 6 votes who say only do the thing where we maintain the cost from the draft no matter what happens in between, even if a player is dropped. And we have 1 vote for we should do both of those 2 things. So we have to wait and see if we end up with a 6-6 vote or if somebody comes in as the 7th vote and puts this one to bed. But I think that the big thing here for listeners, rather than getting into too much detail and sort of the inside baseball of what's happening in our league, is like these are all rules you can be really intentional about and think about, vote on with your league or institute a league constitution, because the way you structure the league can have an impact on how things play out, right? Like if you want, like I wanted to have more alternatives and options for how people stack their keepers, you want to keep it as loose as possible with as few regulations as possible. If instead you're like, no, I really want this to be about, you know, how do you draft? Do you identify talent young and not about who has the most fab left to bid on a certain guy at a certain time? You can limit the number of fab keepers. You can make fab keepers more expensive. And I do think, by the way, I think it's an interesting debate. And I think there's a real argument to say fab keepers should not cost a last round pick. They should cost like a 20th round pick, on the basis that taking a guy in the 28th round who sticks around is arguably more impressive and deserves a larger reward than being the high bid on a breakout. Like being the high bidder on, I don't know, who did I mention for my team? Spencer Schwellenbach or Bowden Francis. Like being the high bidder on one of those guys, like that's not nothing. I can't say I discovered those guys, but like in the moment where they came up for bid, I was willing to put up more than anyone else, and I should get some reward for that. I think you can make a strong case that drafting them in the 28th round would have been more impressive. Right? It's more foresight.
I definitely don't disagree with that. I think it's actually a really good point. I think going from a 28th to a 20th, like that's a big leap.
Yeah.
So like that might actually be more reflective of like that. Like I don't see the point in escalating it 2 rounds or 3 rounds, whatever ended up winning that. Like, all right, now instead of a 28th, it costs a 26. Is that supposed to dissuade people? Like that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
What I do think could work, and again, I'm not going to be the deciding vote because I want to kind of remain neutral. I feel like if you and I both get a vote, it's too much host power. But, you know, if there was more, if inflation worked quicker for fab keepers, right? It's like, yeah, you can keep them for a 28th, but everybody else only escalates in inflation by 1 round. Fab keepers will maybe go by 3. So like, you know, that'll go a little bit quicker. I don't know if that's the answer. I think that could be an interesting solution for keeper leagues out there that are running into this kind of issue, if you want to call it that. And in regards to the Acuna stuff, that also kind of seems like we're dealing in extremes, right? Like either Acuna gets cut and you get him and now you can keep him for a first, or, you know, it just doesn't matter. Like it doesn't do anything to his cost, or he gets cut and you can keep him for a 28th. Like, you know, maybe. And I'm not trying to throw a monkey wrench in there. You know, that sail has passed, that ship has sailed. But like, all right, if I drafted a guy in the 4th round and I cut him, then whoever adds him gets like a 10 round discount. So now he costs a 14th. I think this is what I love about keeper leagues. And one of the reasons why we started this podcast is there's just so many directions you can take these rules and so many solutions you can find. And Chad's right. Something he said earlier was like, you can't do these changes right away. You can't do them in season. And you've got to give managers a heads up. And if they're keeper related, you've got to wait a season so that people can adjust and nothing changes their immediate plans. Which is why I'm sure Chad, your leagues are kind of the same way. My home league that's been around for almost 20 years now, our constitution is like 4 pages long. And to some of you, that might sound stressful and terrible, but to us, like we've made this document over so many years and we love our unique rules. As they continue to shape the league that we play in. And even though it's 4 pages, it sounds like it's a super strict league. It's not. It's really, you can do all sorts of different things with your team, which is why we love keeper leagues.
Yeah.
So we get some more stuff to jump into, but before we do, Chad, let's take our final break. Welcome back, folks. Keeper Cup Podcast, Pete Ball, Chad Young, talking about keeper leagues and rules and settings and all sorts of stuff. And Chad, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that was the last vote for Listener League 2, the one related to cut players and what their cost is ultimately going to be.
Yeah.
All right. Nice. So we can move on to some of our other topics for today's episode. And Chad, you made some keeper rankings for your team in the Roto Listener League. So that's Keeper Cut Listener League 1. But remember, we're just talking players and ranking them. So why don't you walk us through what you did there?
Yeah, I think what's sort of interesting here is I've been trying to figure out, and this has been like an ongoing thing for me with draft leagues, right? Where figuring out how to value keepers is hard, I think. In auction leagues and on an auto new league, like, I find it generally straightforward. It's hard to do the valuation, but the basic idea is you want to keep the players whose value is highest relative to their cost, right? Like, and it's easy to evaluate value and cost in an auction league from the perspective that you can break value down to a dollar, their cost is in a dollar. You can take, you know, the value minus the cost, and that's your surplus. And that the higher the surplus, the better the value. Great. Easy. You know, it's not actually easy. It's really hard. But the logic behind it is pretty straightforward. In draft leagues, it's a little harder because you've got to figure out how to value the player and the cost. And, you know, we've talked about this before that, like, it's like one way I have done this is by looking at the round surplus based on ADP. So if a player is going in the 25th round, or sorry, if a player is going to cost me a 25th round pick and they're going in the 10th round, I'm saving 15 rounds. Straightforward, easy to calculate. I know I can find out what their cost is. I can find out what their ADP is. Like, that's easy to do. But it's not really a fair value because, like, a 25th round cost for a 15th round player, let's do that. 25th round cost, 15th round player is a 10 round, quote unquote, surplus. A 15th round cost for a 5th round player is also a 10 round surplus. It is a way, way, way better surplus, right? Mm-hmm. There's a huge difference in the value that you get from a 5th round player in the 15th round is way more valuable than a 15th round player in the 25th. So that was one way I was calculating and trying to compare my players. And so I was like, well, what if I looked at compared a player's value? So I used the auction calculator on an auction calculator on Fangraphs to basically say, what's this player's dollar value in this structure? And then I sorted all of the players by their dollar value and assumed that they got picked in that order and set pick values based on that. So basically what I mean by that is, once I had sorted all these players, I could go down and be like, okay, the 183rd most valuable player according to that auction calculator is Nate Uvalde. His value according to that auction calculator in this format is $5. And therefore, actually $5.03, if we want to be precise, therefore, the 183rd pick is worth $5. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So then what I can say is, if I have to give up a roughly 183rd pick, was that a 15th round pick, something like that, for a guy who is worth $10, they have $5 of surplus. And this is pretty helpful because, like, if I look at the top of the draft, the first round, the first pick in the first round, according to this, would be Aaron Judge at $56. By the first pick of the second round, you're looking at Tarek Skubal, whose value is $35, a $21 difference between the top of the first and the top of the second. The difference between the top of the second and the top of the third is $9. The difference between the top of the third and the top of the fourth is $5 or $6, right? So you start to see this compression where, like, a first round pick, an early first round pick is worth a lot more than a late first round pick is worth a lot more than an early second round pick is worth a lot more than a third round pick is worth more than a fourth round pick. It's starting to get a little bit even with a fifth round pick and a fifth and a sixth. You know, you still want the fifth, but it's not that crazy different. A 10th and an 11th maybe aren't really that different. And so you start to get this, you know, flattening of the curve, and it allows me then to go back and look. And so here's an example of this sort of in action for my team, is that Yiner Diaz, who I mentioned I picked up as a fab player, and so therefore he can be kept for a 28th round pick. His ADP right now on Fantrax is in the 8th round. So I could say 20 round value, right? That is one way I can look at that. Another way I can look at that is to say his value, according to the ranking I did using the Fangraphs auction calculator, is $12.31. The value of the pick I have to give up for him is -$2.71. Now, -$2 is a weird way to look at it. I should scale this differently, and I will at some point, but it doesn't matter. It's fine for now. But that tells me that his surplus as a player is about $15. I'm going to get about $15 more in value by keeping him than I would by throwing him back and taking someone else with that pick. The other way I could look at it is, what is the value of his ADP versus the value of his pick? And this is a little bit of a weird one, but this case, for him, it's sort of interesting. His value, the value of the pick I'd have to give up for him is about $12.70. It's not that different from his player value. But I have other players where that's not true. Like Byron Buxton, projections still like him. And so his value shows up at $9.30. His ADP is only $2. And the value of the pick I'd have to give up for him is also -$2.71 or whatever. So if I look at his value versus that, he shows up as like a $12 value and as my second most valuable potential keeper. If I look at what it would cost, now the reason I use the ADP one is because that ADP value tells me how much he's worth, how much value I get by keeping him rather than by just picking him at his ADP. If I could just guarantee I could pick Buxton at ADP, the pick value of his ADP is $2, which makes him about a $4 value rather than a $12 value. And that puts him outside my top nine. So if I believe I can get Buxton or someone like Buxton at pick, you know, 235, which is his ADP, I don't lose as much by letting him go as I do by keeping him. So that one gets sort of interesting. Then I started to think about, like, what about inflation, right? We talk about inflation in auto new leagues all the time. Again, in auctions, inflation isn't that hard to calculate. So what I did here was I went through each team, and this makes it sound like it was this big, massive thing. I literally just took the nine best values using, I chose one of those systems. I think the player value on the second one I talked about. I chose the nine best players on each team based on that, and I assumed they were kept. And then I reset everyone's ADP based on that. So instead of a player being the 100th pick, they might be the 45th pick or the 60th pick or the whatever. And I did an inflated player cost or player value. And it does move the needle a bit. And there are some cases where, like, just as an example, Reynaldo Lopez shows up as my seventh best value player by the value surplus. If I inflate his ADP, he shows up as my fourth best value. Spencer Steer is my 12th best by value. When I inflate the value, he's my fifth best because he's going to move up so much in the draft that it's going to drive up his cost so much that he actually becomes a better keeper. And so I did both an inflated value version and an inflated round version. And so I have five different ways of ranking these players. And there's a handful of guys who through those five different methods stand out. Yiner Diaz shows up very consistently as my top value. Now I think I need to rethink a little bit how I'm valuing catchers, because I think Yiner Diaz is a keeper in this format. I'm not sure I believe he's truly my top value. And so the fact that he shows up top in all of these is something I need to address. Spencer Schwellenbach is tied with Diaz in one of the five and is second or third in all of the rest. Tanner Bibee is third or fourth in all of them. Elliot Ramos is fifth, sixth, or seventh in all of them. Reynaldo Lopez, third, fourth, fifth, and seventh. And Andrés Giménez surprised me a little bit, but 6th, 7th, 8th, or 9th, no matter how I value it. So those five guys, no matter what version I take, are all inside my top nine. Then I've got a bunch of guys, Buxton, Mason Miller, Zach Neto, Ranger Suarez, Spencer Steer, and Bowden Francis, who show up inside my top nine in at least one of those systems. All of them, it's actually more than one. And then I've got some guys who are very close to the top nine. Rhett Lauder gets kind of close. Luis Ortiz gets kind of close. And so that's starting to give, it's starting to help me. Lars Nootbaar also kind of close. It's starting to allow me to triangulate, like, here are five or six guys I'm going to keep. It's probably for me right now more like three to four that I'm confident in. And then 10 more that I could, which will help shape my offseason strategy. And I'll refine this process as I get closer to keeper decisions in January to narrow it down and be ready to make my decisions. But I think the sort of the big thing here for listeners to take out of this is that as you're valuing players in a draft situation, don't just settle for I save 10 rounds of ADP, therefore he's a good value, because saving those 10 rounds can be something really different, right? I mean, Buxton was sort of the prime example there, but here's another one is Mason Miller. Versus ADP, he's not that good a value because closers, especially at this point in the season, their ADPs just aren't that high. People don't really know what Miller's job is going to be. But if I look at his production as predicted by Fangraphs depth charts projections, and I use those projections in that auction calculator, he shows up as my sixth best value versus the cost it would be to keep him. And that's, by the way, he's going to cost me a ninth round pick if I keep him. So he is, like, even against that cost, projections say he's one of my best keeper options, clearly within my top nine. Now, when I start to inflate costs, he falls way off because he doesn't inflate as much, right? A ninth round pick, he might move up to the sixth, seventh round, but a guy who's going in the 20th round might move up. You know, there's going to be 100 and some odd, 108 keepers. A guy who was going in the 20th round before might move up eight, nine rounds. And so their cost, right, gets much higher. Their cost to reacquire them gets much higher versus Miller, who goes from a ninth round pick to maybe, like I said, a sixth, seventh round pick. So I'm you know, still playing around with this. I'm still thinking through this. I'm not sure where exactly I'm going to land for both of these leagues. But it's a reminder that as you're starting to figure out your keepers in these draft leagues, like, don't just say, I'm taking the nine guys or eight guys or whatever it is who move up the most rounds versus their ADP, right? Like, that's not the way to do it, because you're going to leave a lot of value on the table by saying, you know, this guy's a 16th round pick and I can get him for a 27th round pick. Like, I can, he only cost me a 27th. Like, that seems great. But if you've got a third round pick that'll only cost you a sixth, that's probably better.
That makes total sense. I love that first system particularly. That was one that you brought up last year, where, you know, comparing it to auction value as opposed to just ADP, or not ADP, but round value, yeah, right? Which is just a fool's errand to just go by round value. But I kind of have two follow-up questions for you, where in the Keeper Cut listener leagues, and I'm sure in keeper leagues that so many of our listeners are in, you also have the ability to just not keep a player.
Yeah.
So, like, maybe walk the listeners through some of your decisions of, like, all right, my eighth or ninth guys, these are my eighth or ninth most valuable keepers. But, like, what would maybe indicate to you that you're just not going to use those keeper spots? To me, like, if there's value, I'm usually going to keep them. Yeah. But maybe if there's too much position repetition, or I just don't trust the health of the player or something like that, I think I could just keep the pick. Is there ever a situation, though, where there is value, but you're going to choose to keep the pick instead?
I don't think so. So I'll say this. I rarely find myself on a team with nine keepers. Nine is starting to be maybe borderline. Like my CBS league, we keep 14. Mm-hmm. Out of new leagues, you can keep everybody, right? Theoretically, an out of new league is just a keep 40. That's what it is. You just don't have to keep all 40. And we always make choices to get rid of players in our new teams because they're players who aren't valuable. And so like, if I look at my list right now, like I have guys on this list who like Itzhak Paredes, who I still like, I'm not ready to be done on Itzhak Paredes. I've got him for a ninth last year. Most of last year, I was like, this is great. He's going to be a seventh round. Like now he's not going in the seventh round. There's no reason for me to keep him. I can get him later. Or I can get him in the seventh if I need to. Like, it's just, there's no reason for me to keep him there. I don't really anticipate that I want to keep Joe Ryan for a fifth rounder, given his ADP is in the ninth. Mm-hmm. Right? So if those guys, like, if I just didn't have nine guys better than that, fine. I won't use all those. So that's the first and I guess most obvious one is like, if these guys have negative value, if you can get them back, I would keep in mind, it's if you can get them back at their inflated cost, right? So like Joe Ryan would cost me a fourth round pick. His ADP is in the 10th round. Now, after inflation, his ADP moves up to the fifth round. No, it's actually the sixth. Now I think about it. It'd be the 63rd pick, basically. So early sixth round. He's still not worth a fourth round pick. But if he were costing me a eighth round pick, it'd be real easy to be like, eighth round pick, ninth round ADP, 10th round ADP, I don't want him. But I can't get him back in the 10th. I can only get him back in the 6th. And so I might keep him in that case. But in this case, I'm not going to. He doesn't have value. The second thing you talked about is positional stuff. Like, it's pretty rare with nine keepers that I'm like, wow, four of my best keepers are second basemen. Right? Because like, in general, it just doesn't happen. You could find yourself in a situation where like four of your best keepers, like you had two really good second basemen at good cost last year. Someone got hurt. You replace them. The guy you replaced them with broke out. And now you've got three great second basemen. Like that could happen. And if it happens, you should make a trade. Right. And that assumes you can do trades. But like we're about to open up trading in these leagues. Like that's where I'm looking to trade that guy for some other position. But the reality is like, if I have a great value on a guy, I'm just going to deal with the fact that I have too many second basemen and I'll fix that in the draft or after the draft. If it's a okay value, then maybe I would move on, but it's pretty rare. It's more likely that I'll find myself in a situation like that and go, man, I have 11 guys I would keep. And even though this second baseman is my seventh best of those options, he's also my fourth second baseman. And so he's not going to be one of them. Like that might happen. I don't know that I can really think of other situations. I guess the only other situation would be if over the course of trading, I find myself making a bunch of consolidation trades, I may end up in a situation, but that's really the same as the first case I was talking about, right? That's really going back to like, I only have seven guys with positive value to keep. So why would I?
Right.
So no, in general, I can't really think of a reason to waste one of those spots unless you really look and you're like, literally none of these guys are worth the pick. I will get better players at every single one of those picks. So I might as well just let them all go. And that might happen.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Especially that bit, you know, I was thinking, all right, I have those four second basemen, right? And the worst one is your seventh. Then yeah, you're just going to keep your 10th best keeper and let that guy go into the draft or look for a trade. It's the responsible thing to do for your team anyway.
Yeah, I have had that CBS league where we keep 14. I have had situations and lots of teams have in that league where they don't use all 14 because there are times it's only 25 man rosters on top of everything else. So you're keeping more than half your roster. It is not hard, especially if you're contending and you've sold some good value, good future value to buy for this year. It is not that hard to end up in a situation where you look at your roster and you're like, yeah, I don't know that I have 14 keepers I really want to keep. And like, I'm looking at my team in that league, pull it up right now real quick. I don't know if I have prices on all these guys in front of me, so I may not be able to do this in any effective way. But as I look at my roster there, I have Blake Snell as a keeper. I have Chris Sale. Lindor is expensive. Lux, I don't think I'm going to keep. Kirby. Cole, I think I have a good price. Jared Jones. Jason Foley, if he's a keeper. I don't think I'm going to keep John Kenzie Noel. I am going to keep Jose Ramirez. Kerry Carpenter, I'll keep. I don't think I'm going to keep Luis Ortiz. Marcus Simeon's crazy expensive. Probably end up keeping Matt Wallner. Matt Olson is borderline. Parker Meadows, I'll keep. Devers is probably too expensive. River Ryan is not a keeper. Sir Anthony Dominguez is not a keeper. I think Steer is a keeper. I think Hauk is a keeper. I think Willier is a keeper. That's 14 exactly. We get two players voted off in that league. So pending how the offseason goes and what kind of trades I make, I probably won't keep 14 players in that league this year.
And that makes sense. I mean, you compared it earlier and mentioned how new leagues are basically 40 player keepers, right? And I am a merciless cutter in new leagues because during the season, usually I like to really go for it, which means I'm moving away pieces that would be keepers, right? And I'm bringing in pieces that are at best at value, at worst, they're overpays, but I can take out loans and stuff like that. And it really is no different in keeper leagues where those teams that are contending typically have, by the end of the season, less values to lean on because they've made moves to compete, whereas the other teams have been able to stock up. So you just might not be able to meet that number of 9 or 14. In the other direction, Chad, and I, we're right around that 1 hour mark, so this might wrap it up. In smaller keeper leagues, is there a system that you maybe put more weight into where, like, in a smaller keeper league, you really want your keepers to land, right? Like, you want values. It's still the
by
most
smaller, you just
thing.
Mean like a keep 3, keep 4 kind of thing rather right. than a keep 9.
Exactly. So if you're in a keep 3, a keep 4, you know, does your thought process using these systems change at all? Is it more just like, let's try to stock up the team with studs to make sure we have that strong base? Or is it more same system, same mindset?
It's interesting. So I'll be honest, I don't, these keep 9s are literally the lowest number of keepers in any of my leagues. So
interesting.
I don't know. My first thought is, like, my initial thought is sort of what you were saying, like, oh, like, you only have 3, you need to hit on them. I'm way more likely, and, you know, it always depends on the cost structure and stuff like that, but I'm way more likely to keep stars because, like, I want those stars and you may not be able to get them otherwise.
Right.
My other thought process, though, is maybe it's an upside play because you can always come up with 3 keepers, right? Mm-hmm. And now this does depend if it's just keep 3 at no cost. It's a different story. I play in a football league that is keep 4 and there's no cost associated with it. And there's some contract stuff that goes on there, but there's effectively no cost on those guys. And in that case, I just keep my 4 best players. Doesn't matter who they are. I keep my 4 best. And I am only worried about who are the 4 best players. That's the only thing I think about. In a baseball league with keep 3, keep 4, it would be the same thing if there's no cost. If there is a cost, I think it is so easy to come up with 3 or 4 keepers that I'd be more inclined to play an upside game. Who are the 3 guys I could keep that at their cost could just be the core of my team for the next decade because they have that kind of upside and I could keep them year after year after year, even as their cost increases. And if 2 of them hit and 1 of them doesn't, that's awesome. And I try again the next year with a different guy. And I think that's more likely what I would do. I think I'd be playing an upside game. Now, that doesn't mean I wouldn't keep, like, Aaron Judge. If you have a good price on an Aaron Judge, you still keep him. But I would be, you know, if I know I'm going to get a first round pick and I know that guy, like, it's only keep 3 and that guys like Judge or Vlad or whoever might be available because they cost so much the year before, I think I'm going to play the upside game.
Yeah, that makes total sense. I think you're allowed to take more risk because, as you said, you can always find 3 keepers, even 4 keepers. I play in a lot of 4 keepers. It's not that hard to find 4 keepers. So taking the big swings is usually the best move. Well, folks, we are over an hour, so we're going to call it there. You know, make sure you give Chad a follow at Chad Young. Check out the show every other week. Again, we're airing every other week during the off season on Mondays. But before you know it, we'll be back full time. And check out some of the other awesome podcasts on the Pitcherless Podcast Network. There, I nailed it. We'll see you in a couple of weeks.